to look. A clipped nasal voice was talking rapidly about Japanese envoys and the State Department, Thailand and Manila. The president's press secretary, the voice said, had read a statement to reporters. Slowly, Jamie gathered that Japan had bombed a naval base in Hawaii. A teenage girl two stools down burst into tears. When the reporter said a declaration of war was certain to follow, some people cheered. The program ended with promises of further bulletins, dropped without fanfare back into regularly scheduled programming. The New York Philharmonic playing something dismal and discordant. Jamie didn't know where to go, so he walked toward the waterfront. Apparently, others had the same idea, because a crowd was already gathering. Mostly men, milling around, casting baleful looks to the west, at Bainbridge Island and Japan somewhere beyond it, as though a swarm of airplanes might appear on the gray horizon at any moment, and the men would, what, exactly, throw stones as the bombs rained down? Feeling foolish, Jamie left the crowd to its posturing, walked uphill. The city had taken on a stunned quiet, distinct from a normal, languid Sunday hush. The tinny, ambient buzz of radios seeped from windows. People stood clumped on the sidewalks. To Jamie, the war so far had been like the sun, relentless and undeniable, but not to be looked at directly. Distant continents were being consumed by suffering and death, and even if the impulse was cowardly, he had avoided fully confronting the horror of it for fear that he too would be swallowed up. But there was to be no escape. He felt as he had as a child in the mountains when he'd found himself, more than once, trapped far from shelter as a storm approached, bristling with lightning. From his pocket, he drew Sarah's embossed card. He remembered the street. She lived near Volunteer Park, not far from her parents. Sarah opened the door after he'd rung the bell twice. Her eyes were red-rimmed, and new tears sprang up when she saw him. She didn't seem to question why he'd come, only beckoned him inside, saying, "It's too awful." She hugged him quickly, almost roughly, then lifted the hem of her skirt to wipe her eyes, seeming for a moment like a little girl. "Anyway," she said, laughing a little, "welcome." The Scott residence was an imposing two-story craftsman with a deep front porch. Inside was spacious and airy and surprisingly full of houseplants. Philodendrons sent down tendrils of heart-shaped leaves from shelves and tables. Potted palms stood politely in corners as though waiting to be asked to dance. Geometrically patterned rugs were scattered on walnut floorboards, and an eclectic collection of artwork adorned the walls. The sound of a radio droned from within, growing louder as Sarah led him down a hallway and past a dining room. She stepped around abandoned toys, a metal truck, a hobby horse, a misshapen castle built from wooden blocks. Through a doorway into a small study or library, Jamie glimpsed his old portrait of her, matted and framed, a brass lamp fixed above it.
"Is Lewis home?"
"No. He runs a clinic in one of the shack towns on Sundays. He left before the news came, but he would have gone anyway. People count on him. He's a good man." This last was said with such obvious defensiveness, it gave him a perverse hope.
"And your sons?"
"They slept over at my sister's so we could go to the opening. I haven't been to retrieve them yet. I don't want them to see me this upset. Do you remember my sister Alice? She has two boys almost the same age as ours. Come into the sunroom." The sunroom was bright with flat silver light and crowded with plants. Jamie was reminded of Sarah's mother's conservatory, where he had felt so adult when invited for coffee. The windows looked out onto a sloping lawn, electric green under the overcast sky. From a portable radio set amid a thicket of ferns on a side table came the information that Japanese immigrant populations on the West Coast had been put under strict surveillance. Sarah lowered the volume to a murmur, picked at the ferns. I'm supposed to feel patriotic, I think, but mostly I'm afraid and so angry. She gestured to a wicker chair with floral cushions. I'm sorry. Please sit.
I don't mean to intrude.
She sat on a love seat at right angles to him. I'm glad you came. I've just been staring into space, envisioning what will follow from this. The powerlessness might be the worst part. And the rage. I don't know what to do with it. I'm grateful my boys are so little still. But all those other mothers. I can't think about it. They'll want doctors. I'm sure Lewis will go if he can. I'd go myself if I could. What will you do? The question hadn't occurred to him, though, yes, of course, he was an able-bodied 27-year-old man. He couldn't begin to grapple with the possibilities and so put them aside, saying,
It's hard to imagine you wanting to go to war. I think of you as being so gentle.
Yes, well, I'd prefer a gentler world. But everybody has their limits, don't you think? He remembered his surge of happiness that someone had shot Barclay McQueen.
It seems so.
I feel like I might burst out of my skin with anger. I want Germany and Japan to be nothing but ash and rubble. I want to come down from above in a blaze of vengeance like a Valkyrie and make them pay. Is that at all what Valkyries do? I've never thought about killing anyone, ever. And yet I find myself daydreaming about putting a bullet right between Hitler's eyes. Don't you?
Hitler seems so abstract, like the devil.
He isn't, though. He's a real man. Isn't it strange that one person had the power to start this? That's an oversimplification, but you know what I mean. She closed her eyes briefly. Let's talk about something else. I don't want to waste our time together rambling on about the war. Tell me about your life. Tell me everything that's happened.
Everything? There's so much, but also so little.
We need a starting point. How about, tell me where you live?
Oregon, for now. On the coast. I lived in Canada before that.
You're not married?
Her tone was carefully neutral. He shook his head.
And your sister? Is she married?
So her mother had not told her about Marion's visit to Seattle. Actually, Marion is already a widow.
Sarah's tears, so close to the surface already, welled up. Oh, how terrible. I'm sorry to hear it. Are there children?
No, thankfully.
Yes. It's a mercy they don't have to grieve their father.
Jamie hesitated. I meant something a little different. She didn't want any. Her husband was a vile man. But even if he hadn't been, she wouldn't have wanted any. She only wants to fly airplanes. She doesn't like being bound to people.
Her forehead creased with consternation. Being bound to people is the heart of life. My children have lit me up, lit up the whole world. It's love like you can't imagine.
He smiled ruefully. Be that as it may, I don't know if they're in the cards for me either.
She slumped back into the love seat, exhaling. I'm sorry. I don't know what good there is in my saying something like that. But you'll have them. I'm sure you will.
Maybe, maybe not. I think I'd like them. But I also think Marion would say she knows her own mind. She wants a different kind of life.
I shouldn't have judged. It's no business of mine how your sister lives, or how you live.
This last remark stung. He said, Do you know what this reminds me of?
No, what?
When we walked around the lake together, when we first met, and you extracted my whole life from me, and I didn't realize until later that I hadn't asked you anything about yours.
I'd forgotten about all that.
He must have looked crestfallen because she added hastily,
Not about that day or the walk. I'd forgotten you were so worried about having talked too much. But it was the same then as now. Your life is more interesting than mine.
No.
Oh, there's a bulletin. Will you turn it up?
Jamie reached for the volume knob. Japan had declared war on the United States and Great Britain. After a minute, she said,
That's enough.
He turned down the volume again. Tentatively, he said, I wish there was a way I could just convey everything to you in a flash. Have you know it all without having to tell you?
I don't. I like the way you have to find out about someone little by little.
But we don't have time, and I don't trust myself to explain things right.
She was looking at him keenly. I've always liked how honest you are. That's all you have to be to explain things.
I struggle with the same thing in my paintings. Everything I want to paint is too big. And so I've started to think what I really want to paint is the too bigness. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think so. It's there in the beach painting.
I think I'm drawn to impossibility.
Cautiously, slowly, he reached out and took her left hand in both of his. She let him. Yes, she said quietly after a pause. Impossible.
Your life went on as though I were never in it.
Only outwardly.
Isn't that what matters?
I don't think so. But I'm just... I have an ordinary life, Jamie. You wanted me to rebel, and I couldn't. It's not my way. Sometimes I wish I were less conventional. But the simplest explanation is I don't have the guts.
She gripped his hand more tightly.
I've always only wished you the best. I want you to be happy.
I don't like that, how you say that.
You don't want me to wish you happiness?
No, it's that there's something final about it. He released her hand, hunched forward. Was our summer just a sweet little rite of passage for you? A soprano's aria warbled quietly from the radio while Sarah thought for a long time, staring out at the lawn.
No, she said finally, decisively. But, Jamie, shouldn't it have been? Wouldn't it be better if we decided now, together, that it was? I honestly don't know why it wasn't. Why I haven't completely let go of it. But I have a life. I have children. Even if my feelings about you are complicated, what possible difference could it make?
Her gaze blazed on him like a searchlight, and he felt exposed, as though she could see his most pathetic, persistent hopes and desires. She said firmly,
No good can come from us going to bed. The mention of sex, discouraging though she meant it to be, aroused him.
Trying to sound jokey but fooling neither of them, he said, You don't think it could be worthwhile in itself? She remained outwardly composed, but he had the sense she was struggling. There was so much he didn't know about her. He couldn't guess what all she was weighing in the balance. Finally, with resolve, she said,
I won't ever leave Louis. I love him. It's important you understand that. So I don't see the point. It would just bring us both pain.
Sorrow settled in him, petulant disappointment floating on top. He said, I should go. She didn't argue, but escorted him back through the house. At the front door, they paused. Please give my apologies to Louis for not coming to dinner tomorrow, he said.
I will. She paused.
What will you do?
Will you join up?
I don't know.
You don't want to?
Of course not.
Didn't the idea of animals being mistreated used to drive you to blind fury? Don't you feel the same way about people?
She stopped, placed her hand on his arm, ardent, damp-eyed.
We must be brave.
He saw she was warmed by her sense of her own goodness. Was he, in the same way, seduced by an idea of his own virtue? How could anyone see clearly through the innate haze of self-righteousness? You wouldn't even stand up to your father.
Her hand fell away. You'd compare that to this?
I'm only saying it's easy enough to tell others to be brave when you've always chosen the safest path.
That's not fair.
We're not all as free as you to choose our own way. Choose, yes. You said you wished you were less conventional. Well, you could have been. But you chose over and over again to do what was expected, and that's fine. But don't pretend someone else made you this way.
I don't.
Good. They stood glaring furiously at each other. She yanked open the door and he strode out, donning his hat, hearing the slam behind him but looking resolutely ahead. Away. Out the door, down the street, out of the city. There. He had it. A resolution.
New York City, April 1942, 4 months later.
A doorman ushered Marion off Fifth Avenue and across a black marble lobby into the custodianship of a brass-buttoned elevator operator who wore a faint smirk as he looked her over. He flung the grate closed, cranked over the lever Marion thought of as a throttle, sent them upward. She wondered what the other pilots had worn when they showed up for their interviews. Your floor, miss?
Alone in the hallway, she paused to gather herself, smoothing her trousers, adjusting her logbook under her arm. She knocked, and a uniformed maid opened the door to Jacqueline Cochran's apartment. Inside and into splendor. The foyer's floor was inset with a marble aviator's compass. Along one wall, a glass table and case were crowded with flying trophies, globes and cups and spires and winged figures. A mural of famous aircraft covered the walls and ceiling. Marion craned and swiveled as though she were at an air show. The Wright Flyer, the Spirit of St. Louis, Amelia's Lockheed Vega, a squadron of biplanes, a stray Zeppelin, and of course, Jackie herself winning the Bendix Transcontinental Race. In Alaska, in February, Marion had heard from a pilot who'd heard from his sister who flew crop dusters in California about a telegram she'd received from a woman named Cochran. She was recruiting female pilots to join the Air Transport Auxiliary in Britain, ferrying warplanes. Every front now our front, the telegram said. For those desiring quick active service short of actual combat, but including flight experience with combat planes, this service abroad seems ideal chance. Marion, panicked she would be too late, had cabled Jackie Cochran directly, giving a truncated explanation of her bush flying, a tally of her hours, a plea for consideration. War planes. If they took her, she would fly war planes. The kind of aircraft she'd seen transiting through Alaska ever since Lend-Lease passed. Hundreds of them bound for Russia. An answer tap-danced in along the wires the next day. Come to New York for an interview. If satisfactory, you will proceed directly to Montreal for flight check and from there to England. The maid steered her across a grand living room where a man was talking on the telephone in clipped, businesslike tones, and down a hallway, its walls frescoed with more aircraft. A smartly dressed young woman brushed by, carrying an armful of files. Marion paused to examine a framed newspaper photo of Jackie in a cockpit, holding up a small hand mirror to apply lipstick. In a bright room with windows open over the East River, Jackie sat behind a white and gold desk, half submerged in a lake of papers held down against the warm breeze by paperweights of different sizes and materials, a brass eagle, a hunk of amethyst, a compass. As she stood and reached across to shake Marion's hand, Marion absorbed her careful blondness, the red silk of her belted dress. She seemed a lacquered and corrected sort of person, a flattering portrait of a woman painted atop that very woman. After they sat down, Jackie toggled a finger at Marion. This won't do. Marion thought Jackie was summarily rejecting her. I won't. You need to be an ambassador. You're meant to represent American women, ladies, not grease monkeys. Her accent was carefully refined, but underneath was a disguised twang, a sharp elbow. Marion looked down at herself. I thought about getting a dress. Why on earth didn't you? In the morning, she'd hesitated outside the glass doors of Macy's, stylish ladies sweeping past, the corners of their shopping bags bumping her imperiously. She'd glimpsed gleaming floors and counters, bottles of perfume, her own incongruous reflection. I didn't want to get my hopes up, she told Jackie. That's all inside out. You must dress for your aspirations. I don't aspire to be anything other than a pilot. Jackie's smile was more of a wince. Don't be stubborn. You must know they want the contrast. The magazine pictures of the pretty girl like any other, neat as a pin, hair curled, serving coffee and cake, who happens to be the same girl flying the big plane. You can't have the pilot without the lady. So the lipstick in the cockpit was an armoring, not an obeisance or a pandering affectation, but something more like a beetle settling its wings down into a smooth shield. An incomplete history. Jacqueline Cochran is born Bessie Lee Pittman in 1906, raised in shabby itinerancy in the humid sawmill towns of northern Florida by people who are almost certainly her biological parents, though later she'd tell everyone she was an orphan, preferring the idea of herself as separate. She is one of five children, a barefoot urchin, a crab catcher and chicken thief. The story she tells, and it's likely true enough, is that she wore dresses made of flour sacking and slept on a straw mattress in a shack on stilts with oiled paper for window panes. A leering old man tells her she'd started out as a boy, but an Indian had shot her through with an arrow when she was very small, making her navel and surprising her so thoroughly that she'd sat down on an axe, becoming a girl. A girl is a boy who has sat on an axe, he says. She wonders why boys still have navels then. Had they not been surprised when the Indian shot them? Or was it that there weren't any axes around? The air smells of the high, sharp burn of a blade through wood. A fine layer of sawdust sticks to her skin. She wanders where she will. When she is very small, she witnesses a man lynched in the woods, burned. Bessie Lee, 8 years old, has a night job pushing a cart through a cotton mill, bringing spools to the weavers. As Jackie Cochran will tell it one day, that's how she earns the money to buy her first pair of shoes. She knows to eat her lunch quickly and hide in her cart for a nap, hopefully unnoticed by the men. She learns to punch and kick, which is sometimes enough. Soon, she gets promoted to spinner and walks until dawn between the rows of bobbins, looking for snags. Lint in her lungs, ears full of the screeching machines. The steamy, hot southern night presses down on the mill's long roof, presses down on the cotton fields and the red clay earth as the child reaches into a machine and ties a broken thread back together with her small, nimble fingers, sets the bobbins spinning again. Bright little girl. Again, she is promoted. She oversees a gang of 15 children who inspect the newly woven fabric for flaws, 15 bent and wizened miniature people, hunched like jewelers over smooth, rippling, cool cotton. During a mill strike, 10 years old, she gets a job in a beauty shop, sweeping up shorn hair and mixing shampoo. Here begins her rise. Jackie clasped her hands on her desk, said to Marion, "If you're picked, you'll transport planes where they need to go. From factories to airfields, for example, or from airfields to repair depots or vice versa, freeing up RAF pilots for combat. No matter your experience, you'll start with trainers. Everyone does. If you're good enough, you'll upgrade from there. You'll learn a whole class of planes, twin engines, say, and then be expected to transport types you've never flown before just by reading the specs. It's an actual, concrete contribution, but it will be difficult. Do you think you're up for it?" Marion was so terrified of saying something that would mean she would not get to do what Jackie had described. She found she could not speak. She nodded. "Yes," said Jackie. A whisper. "Yes." "Did you fly here from Alaska?"
"Yes."
"In what?"
"A Beechcraft 18.
"How long did it take?"
9 days.
"Not a speed record, then."
"There was some weather, and I stopped to visit my brother in Oregon." Poor Jamie, cornered by his own goodness, trying to talk himself both into and out of joining up. "What should I do?" he'd said. She said maybe he could get a job making recruitment posters. She wanted him safe.
"In Alaska, you must be used to weather."
"I'm used to it being awful."
"Good. The Brits aren't teaching ATA pilots to fly on instruments, so you'll have a leg up. There's lots of cloud and fog over there, and it comes on you quick."
"Why aren't they teaching them instruments?"
Jackie poked at a stack of papers. "They say because they want the ferry pilots to stay within sight of the ground and not be tempted to go over the top. It's wishful thinking. The climate there is pernicious." She paused briefly to let Marion admire the word. "You get caught out, and then what? Even if you know what you're doing, it's hazardous. You've heard of Amy Johnson, the English girl who flew to Australia? She was flying for the ATA and had plenty of experience on instruments, and she still got stuck above the cloud and bailed out and drowned. I don't mean to scare you. You'd have heard about it anyway before long."
"I know lots of pilots who've died."
"Me too. By the way, if you get over there, don't tell the Brits I was complaining. They think I complain too much, but in my opinion, not teaching instruments is a waste of airplanes and pilots. They say safety is the reason for it. I think it's more about more about being fast and cheap. What's that word?
Efficiency? Expediency?
Expediency. That's it. I'm always learning new words. I collect them. What sort of schooling did you get?"
"Only to 8th grade.
But you know words."
"I read a lot as a kid."
For the first time, like a lighthouse newly lit, Jackie emitted a gleam of fellow feeling. "So you're like me.
An autodidact. That means you're not afraid to work.
I like to work.
Do you know, I bought my own Model T when I was 14, with money I made doing hair.
By 11, Bessie Lee Pittman is cutting hair, rolling and pinning and plaiting it. She has a way with beauty, with improvement. Respectable women come in through the shop's back door, embarrassed by their vanity, while the prostitutes, the fancy girls, march in the front. Bessie Lee likes the fancy girls, the stories their madam tells about distant cities. She doesn't tell Marion, or anyone, this part of the story. 14 or so, she comes up pregnant, marries the father, Robert Cochran. The baby stays with the Pittmans in Florida while she moves to Montgomery, buys herself that Model T with money made from doing permanent waves. But is being a beautician enough? For her? For little Robert Jr.? She trains to become a nurse, takes a job with a doctor in a mill town. In the light of an oil lamp with a corncob wick, she extracts a baby from a woman laboring on a too familiar straw mattress. Three other children are lying on the floor. There's no clean blanket to wrap the baby. No, this is all wrong. This must not be her life. Robert Jr., playing in the Pittman's backyard, 4 years old, dies in an accident. A fire. He's buried under a heart-shaped headstone. Jackie erases him from her story of herself. Can't bear not to. Away, away, she must get away. 20 years old, divorced. Jacqueline Cochran arrives in New York City, gets herself hired at Antoine's Beauty Salon in Saks Fifth Avenue. Monsieur Antoine, Antoine de Paris, the original celebrity stylist, has a flair for the next big thing. He'd invented the shingle cut and a charmingly gamine coif as short as a boy's that he gave to Coco Chanel, Edith Piaf, Josephine Baker. He likes Jackie and her strict lipstick and resolutely powdered nose, the whiff of sawdust under her expensive perfume. Every winter, she travels from New York to Antoine's Miami outpost, driving her Chevrolet in one long go, picking up hitchhikers for company. In Miami, there are speakeasies and jazz bands and casinos, swanky supper clubs, cocktails, and long white beaches. You wouldn't know there was any Great Depression from Jackie's silk stockings, her gold compacts with little round mirrors that show only her a bit of herself at a time. But none of it is enough. None of it lasts. Curls go limp. Oil seeps through the powder. Up in the panhandle, there's still that grave marked by a heart. The night sky presses on the roof of her hotel, on the palm trees and its gardens and the flamingos sleeping under them. The wish to break free persists. But break free from what? The gilded life she has so laboriously constructed around herself? Away, away. But to where?
I bought myself a Ford, too, as a kid, Marion says. I earned the money driving a delivery truck. Jackie's approval shone more brightly.
Is that so? Laudable. What will you do with the Beechcraft if you go abroad?
Sell it, maybe. Store it. I don't know.
It's had a hard run already. I've been a bush pilot.
I know. Your telegram said.
Jackie held out her hand for Marion's logbook, flipped to the last page, looked at the total hours. Her plucked and penciled eyebrows rose and flexed.
I was surprised I hadn't heard of you, if you've flown this much. I thought I had a good idea of the most experienced girls out there. But this goes to show.
Marion waited to hear what it went to show, but Jackie just kept paging through the book.
I've kept mostly to the north, she said, and to myself.
You've certainly flown. Goaded by the remembered gleam of the flying trophies, the gleam of Jackie's hair, Marion said, I have more hours than are in there. A lot more. At once, Jackie clouded over. Why aren't they recorded? Marion shouldn't have said anything. She looked hard out the window, trying to think how to explain that she'd flown for a bootlegger without a license, that she'd been Jane Smith before she could be Marion Graves again. For a while, she said finally, I was going by a different name. Why? I'd left my husband, and I didn't want him to find me. Where is he now? He's dead. I see. Jackie followed her gaze out the window, seemed to be thinking. In 1932, Jackie finds herself at a dinner party in Miami, seated beside a Wall Street millionaire still in his 30s, Floyd Odlum. He is from Union City, Michigan, humble roots, a Methodist minister's son who'd made himself into a financier. In 1929, he'd had a bad feeling, heebie-jeebies severe enough that he sold off most of his holdings before the crash. After, he bought up companies cheap. They say he is the only man in America to make money on the Depression. He'd heard there was a woman at dinner who actually worked for a living. He didn't meet many of them, and asked to be seated next to her. Over crab cakes, he asks, What do you want? The salt, if you wouldn't mind, Jackie says. Ha, I meant in life. Her own cosmetics company. But there is so much territory, so much competition, especially with everybody tightening purse strings, some people left with just strings and no purse. Little luxuries go a long way when you're feeling downtrodden, she says. He says, hope in a lipstick. That's right. What if you learn to fly an airplane, he says. You could cover big distances faster. She has never considered flying. But something about the idea begins to gnaw and nibble at her right then. She wonders aloud, could I fly a plane? Of course you could, he says so firmly she has no choice but to believe him. She recognizes then that he will be essential to her. He is an external font of self-belief. To him, she is another undervalued commodity, an asset to be picked up cheap and made mighty. He is already married, but so what? The first time she goes up, the flying bug bites. The bug swallows her whole. This is it. This is a way. Still looking out the window, Jackie says, Do you like New York? Grateful to be released from talk of her husband, Marion says, I'm not at home in cities. Anchorage and Nome and Fairbanks had swelled with the war, but were still just frontier towns. Since Pearl Harbor, there'd been blackouts at night. Everyone in the territory was on edge. Is this your first time here? No, I was here years ago for my honeymoon, only for a few days. Jackie regarded her curiously, but seemed to decide against probing further. All right, listen. If you go to England, you'll have to sign an 18-month contract with the ATA. Are you prepared to do that?
Sure.
Yes?
Yes.
The job won't be cushy.
I wouldn't know what to do with cushy.
Still, I have an obligation to tell you it'll be dangerous. Long hours, bad weather, rationed food and fuel, trigger-happy anti-aircraft gunners, beat-up planes that might fall apart in midair. No radio. Germans buzzing around looking for something to shoot down. Barrage balloons all over the place. Your ship could even be sunk on the way over.
Marion hadn't thought about the crossing. Has that happened?
To plenty of people, but none of my girls. Yet. She peered at a page in the logbook. After more flipping, she closed the book, held it out to Marion. Are you up for it?
Marion reached to take back the book.
Sure.
That's a yes?
Yes.
1 manicured finger tapped the desk. The brown gaze lingered on her.
Clothes aside, the brass is concerned our girls be of the highest moral character.
All right.
They're petrified of embarrassment. Some of the men who've gone over already behaved badly, so the girls have to be impeccable. There's no room for error, none at all. When people expect you to be common, you have to work twice as hard not to be.
Floyd helps Jackie get her cosmetics business off the ground. Company motto, Wings to Beauty. He helps her get her physical self off the literal ground, too. She makes her debut on the air racing scene in 1934, showing up at a starting line in Suffolk, England, one of 20 flyers bound for Melbourne. A sputtering engine sets her down in Bucharest, but she reappears the next year in Burbank, California, for the start of the Bendix. Amelia Earhart is first to depart, just before 5 a.m. into a dangerous, thickening fog. The pilot in front of Jackie crashes on takeoff and is killed, burned. While the wreckage is being cleared, Jackie calls Floyd, divorced now, and her fiancé, and asks what she should do. Logic would dictate the safe choice, he says, but logic shouldn't always outweigh a powerful emotional urge. It's a philosophical question. She has not yet told him about Robert Jr., certainly not about the man burned in the woods so long ago. So you have to decide for yourself. The answer is away. But away in the plane or from the plane? She takes off, but when she circles high to escape the fog, her engine overheats and forces her down again. In 1936, she and Floyd marry, buy the 14-room apartment overlooking the East River, where Marion will one day come for her interview. They pick up a country house in Connecticut and a ranch outside Palm Springs. They buy a building in New York and establish an orphanage, really, for the city's barefoot and gimlet-eyed future Jackies. They help pay for Earhart's 1937 circumnavigation attempt, the flight on which she and Fred Noonan disappear, though Jackie says she'd had doubts about Fred finding Howland Island, had warned Amelia to no avail. In 1938, Jackie wins the Bendix. In 1939, she sets a women's record for altitude, 2 national records for speed, 1 intercity record. Prizes and trophies accumulate. She volunteers as a test pilot. In September of that year, after Germany invades Poland, she writes to Eleanor Roosevelt suggesting that, in the event of war, women pilots might be put to use domestically. Supportive flying. Feminine flying. For example, they could deliver trainer planes from factories to bases, freeing up men. The First Lady thanks her for the suggestion. Yes, if we go to war, we will need women to help, she writes. But exactly how women are utilized will be for men to decide. It's the flying I'm interested in, Marion said. If I wanted to run around, I could have done it in Alaska. Mostly, I've wanted to be left alone.
Mostly.
All right. Well, just don't go hinting to anyone that you have more hours than are in here. Everything needs to be by the book, and in the book. Understood?
Sure. I mean, yes.
When she laughed, Jackie pulled her chin inward, compressing her flesh. Marion warmed to the flaw. You're a quick study, like me. Once you get to Montreal, the ATA will want you to get checked out before they take the trouble of shipping you over. My advice? Be nice to the Czech pilot. He's the sort that'd rather see you in the kitchen. Marion said,
He'd be disappointed by what I cooked.
June 1941. Jackie wrangles her way into flying a Hudson bomber across the Atlantic from Montreal to Scotland. Male ATA pilots in Montreal don't like the idea. Not so long ago, people got parades for flying the Atlantic. When word gets out about Jackie, the pilots threaten to strike. "Okay, okay," say the bosses. "She'll fly, but a man will take off and land." When Jackie shows up for departure, the Hudson has been drained of antifreeze, and the oxygen system is set up wrong, and the special wrench for turning on the oxygen has gone missing. Jackie fixes things, buys a new wrench. The life raft is gone as well. But since it probably wouldn't be much help anyway, she leaves without it. When they stop to refuel in Newfoundland, the wrench vanishes again. Someone breaks a cockpit window. She buys another wrench, patches the window with duct tape. They make it across the ocean just fine. Jackie at the controls until she sets up the final approach and relinquishes her seat. "My secretary will sort you out with the hotel in Montreal where we've put the other girls," Jackie told Marion. "And you need to get some new clothes. Today. The ATA will fit you for uniforms in London, assuming you pass. But you should have a traveling suit and a few dresses. Most of the time you can probably get by with slacks. Not those you're wearing, nice slacks. And you'll need a few blouses and a pair of pumps and some plain Oxfords." As she spoke, she jotted a list on monogrammed stationery. "Don't overdo it, though. Some of the girls have brought along steamer trunks full. Do you have money? I could send my girl with you to shop."
"I have money."
"I'll call my woman at Saks. She'll be expecting you. Ask for Mrs. Spring. She'll take you to the hair salon, too. Antoine's. They know me there." She stood. "Good luck."
Marion stood too, shook hands.
"I'll see you over there if you go," Jackie said. "Behave yourself, and don't crash any planes without good reason, and you'll be fine."
At the door, Marion stopped, turned back. "If you don't mind, I'd rather keep it between us that I've been married. Is that all right?"
Jackie gave her a long look, a small nod. After Jackie returns from Britain, she dines with the Roosevelts. Again, pitches her idea about using women ferry pilots. "Maybe we'll start looking into it," the president says. Her staff combs through thousands of files, comes up with 150 experienced pilots. But the generals say they have more male pilots than airplanes at the moment. And how should they be expected to house a handful of girls on air bases where there are hundreds, maybe thousands of men? Chaos would ensue. So, no. The answer is no. For now, they say, see if the Brits want your girl pilots. The Brits want everything and everyone they can get. In London, Jackie sets herself up in luxurious digs, rents a Daimler, parades around in a mink coat. The ATA doctor, she learns, is planning to strip her girls naked during their physicals, and she says, absolutely not. Digs in about it. A confusing creature to her British counterparts, seemingly both crass and a prude. Back in the cotton mill, sometimes punching and kicking hadn't been enough. In 1953, over a Mojave salt flat, Jacqueline Cochran will be the first woman to break the sound barrier. In 1964, in an F-104G, she will reach a speed of 1,429 miles per hour, faster than any pilot ever. But back to 1942, when 26 American pilots, Jackie's girls, crossed the Atlantic from Montreal to Liverpool, and Marion Graves was among them. Montreal,
June 1942, 2 months after Marion met Jackie. Marion had not known Montreal was on an island, nor had she ever been anywhere where people spoke a language other than English. The sky over Dorval Airport had a fairground atmosphere, snarled with long buzzing ropes of engine noise, crowded with aircraft coming in from factories or leaving for Europe, or wavering through touch-and-goes with student pilots. B-17s passed among single-engine trainers like whales through schools of fish. The larger bombers and transports would head up to Gander and then right across to Ireland or Britain. The smaller fighters and trainers might be taken apart and loaded on ships, or they might fly the ice cube route. Newfoundland, Greenland, Iceland, Britain. A pageant of uniforms was ongoing in the city. The significance of the different colors and insignias at first illegible to Marion. Tiger moths and piper cubs circled and circled the field, trainees at their controls. A season of mass chrysalis, men to pilots. The war demanded more of everything. After 3 weeks in which she managed to snatch only 5 hours of flying, Marion checked out in a bright yellow Harvard trainer, its landing gear doors hanging down like jaunty spats. The cockpit smelled of hot metal and rubber and an elusive acrid note that she had come to think of as the odor of flight itself. The Czech pilot, an American, was, as Jackie had warned, skeptical of women flyers. "But needs must," said one of the other girls staying at the Mount Royal Hotel. A couple of them had bought the Czech pilot a beer, with good results. So Marion did the same, dug out a bright smile, did her best to concoct flattering questions that got him talking about his close scrapes and heroic saves before chronic headaches had sidelined him from the Army Air Corps. A doctor poked and prodded, weighed and measured, took her blood, asked a series of oddly detailed questions about her menstruation. "No flying," he said, "during your menstrual period, as well as 3 days before and 3 days after. It's regulation." "Sure," Marion said. The other girls had warned her about this idiocy, so she'd been prepared to keep a straight face and blandly agree, as if obeying wouldn't mean being grounded half the time. Mostly, her job was to wait. Jackie's girls had been crossing the Atlantic, just 4 or 5 per ship, so they couldn't all be blown to smithereens by the same torpedo. In the meantime, they hung around the airport and the Mount Royal. Usually, Marion drank at night in the hotel bar with the other pilots, the Atlantic ferry boys and Jackie's girls. She wasn't used to so much company. And while the others grew more boisterous as they drank, she got quieter, sat nodding along with the conversation. At some point, she couldn't anticipate until it was upon her. She would get up and leave without saying goodnight. She especially wasn't used to the company of women. Yes, the girls all loved to fly and wanted to take this chance to get out and do something, and most were basically all right. But they tended to have only ever lived with their parents, or perhaps in a lady's dorm at college, or perhaps with a husband. She had hoped she would feel more like she belonged than she did. She told them little about herself. "Aren't you the mysterious one?" said a girl whose father had bought her a plane for her sweet 16. Thank goodness for Ruth. Ruth Bloom, from Michigan. She'd arrived 2 weeks after Marion, and they'd met in the lobby of the Mount Royal, Marion pushing in through the revolving door still in flying clothes, Ruth at the front desk in a blue dress and pumps, her hem on the short side. The beat-up brown suitcases at her feet gave her away as a flyer with their patchwork of gum-backed stickers advertising aircraft manufacturers and air races. She spotted Marion at once, called out, "You must be one of Jackie's girls." Ruth was short and busty, with strong, plump calves and a small but solid waist, a shrewd sort, gregarious, mischief wrapped around her like a feather boa. Her husband was in navigator training in Texas, she said. He was hoping for heavy bombers. She and Eddie had met in a government-sponsored civilian pilot training course open to undergraduates. Not enough men had signed up, so there had been room for her. At least there was once she'd made it clear she wouldn't leave anyone alone until she was let in. Eddie had joined up right after Pearl Harbor, washed out of pilot training, got slotted as a navigator instead. Ruth said she couldn't just sit around twiddling her thumbs while he was off doing his part. She'd gotten the telegram from Jackie, and so here she was. Are you married? She asked Marion. No. Ever get close? Marion looked away. No. I'm nosy, Ruth said without apology. She studied Marion. Something about the appraisal reminded Marion of Miss Dolly's girls. She half expected Ruth to start putting lipstick on her. But Ruth's air of barely contained mirth, her confidence in Marion's friendship from the first instant of their acquaintance, reminded her of Caleb, too. You're striking, she said, even though you're trying hard to hide it. Marion ran a hand over her hair, which had been tidied in the Saks salon, but was flat now from the helmet she wore while flying the open Harvard. She had been instructed to grow it out at least into a bob. I try not to stand out. But you draw attention by making yourself so plain. You must have worked out that much. A small, soft hand darted up and grasped Marion by the chin. Obediently, Marion allowed her head to be turned from side to side as though she were a horse for sale. Ruth seemed to be suppressing a smile. Bashful, she said. Not really, Marion said, pulling free. Ruth's smile broke out fully. If I buy you a drink, will you tell me everything I need to know about this place? They finally left Montreal in midsummer. Four of them together in a cramped cabin on a small Swedish freighter. Marion and Ruth and Sylvie from Iowa and a girl from California who went by Zip. Marion had tried to conceal the depth of her happiness that she and Ruth would travel together and begin their training together, because she wasn't sure how important any particular friendship should be in these times. But Ruth must have been pleased, too, because she'd clinked her beer against Marion's and said, "Thanking my stars, we won't be rested apart, Graves." Marion hadn't seen Caleb or written to him for the better part of a year. Jamie hadn't heard from him either, didn't know if he'd married the schoolteacher. Her silence wasn't out of anger. She was trying not to meddle. She'd always kept a distance from him, really, afraid of what would happen if they put more weight on their long old love than it could bear. With Ruth, she feared overstepping, taking their friendship too seriously, but mostly she felt a pleasure in her company that was tender and heady, almost embarrassing in how much it resembled infatuation. Not only did Ruth understand, without need of explanation, how Marion felt about flying, but she understood what it meant to be a woman who flew. All the frustrations and indignities, the skepticism that buffeted like a headwind. I think he'd pass a centipede if it solemnly promised never to believe it could fly as well as he does, Ruth had said of their Czech pilot. That's all he wants. Not to know you can fly, just to know you know your place. Why a centipede? Marion had said. I can always pick out a leg man. I flashed him a bit of mine, called him a hero. Now I'm bound for London. The way she spoke to Marion was sometimes maternal, sometimes jocular, sometimes flirtatious, always good-naturedly bullying and coaxing and chivying her along. And though Marion would never have expected to enjoy being treated like a pet, it was relaxing simply to do as Ruth bid her. in a small convoy with an old destroyer as escort. They first crossed from Montreal to St. John's, Newfoundland, to wait for a bigger convoy to assemble. Long, slow, warmish days passed at anchor. Marion had sold the Beechcraft, and as she watched planes passing over, bound for Europe, she felt sharp pangs for it. In the evenings, the pilots played cards and drank with the other passengers. Sylvie from Iowa said she was joining the ATA because she'd already met all the men in her town, her county, probably in all of Iowa, and anyway, she'd rather fly planes than build them. Zip said she wanted to fly a Spitfire, obviously, and she wanted to be able to say she'd seen things out in the world. Ruth said, if you just want to say you've seen things, you could stay home and make up stories. Zip rolled her eyes. Of course I really want to see things. Then say that, said Ruth. Zip and Sylvie sunbathed on the prow and wrote letters. Ruth, in dungarees, enlisted Marion to help her paint the ship's railings. The crew, amused, handed over brushes and buckets of paint, and then smoked and loitered and watched, commentating among themselves in Swedish, until Ruth grabbed them by the arms and forcibly set them to work. On the warmest day, all four of the pilots stripped down and jumped overboard. Sylvie in a swimsuit she'd been smart enough to bring, and the rest in their underwear. They held hands, but the water ripped their fingers loose. Marion, kicking up to the surface, fought back a horror she couldn't explain at the dark steel wall of the ship's hull underwater. The convoy, 16 ships, left without fanfare one evening, steaming east. The first night, the crewman with the best English came around to issue a reminder about the blackout. He stood in the doorway of their cabin, blushing and looking at the ceiling rather than at the women lounging in their bunks, Sylvie tying up her hair in rags, Zip painting her toenails. He pointed at the curtains over the blacked-out window and said, always keep close, and better this, he gestured at the cabin door, open, always, because a torpedo comes, then the whole ship. He made a motion with his hands like he was wringing out a towel, and then maybe is like, he overlapped one flat hand with the other, pressed them together. Get stuck? Said Zip. Yes, he nodded gratefully. Stuck. If you are inside, then... He shook his head. We're probably not getting out anyway, but thanks for the thought, Ruth said from behind her book. The crewman nodded. Sleep with clothes on, yes, for fast. He whistled and sliced a hand upward, nodded again, and left. When the others wanted to turn out the light, Marion and Ruth went out on deck. If there was a moon, it was hidden behind clouds. In the darkness, they could hear the engines of other ships all around, but saw nothing. A few times, Marion thought she made out a hulking shadow shape off to starboard, but always it dissolved and reappeared elsewhere, a trick of her eyes. I don't like the idea of being stuck in the cabin, she said to Ruth. Getting blown up would be one thing, but being trapped and living long enough to know you're trapped, I don't like it. Me neither, said Ruth. But there's a sense that if you're meant to survive, you survive, and if you're not, you don't. Easy to say while we're nice and alive and standing next to a lifeboat. I think we ought to hone our fatalism. Really, what's the difference between taking your chances on a ship and flying? Flying, you have some control over. Not as much as we like to think. The second day, fog closed in and stayed for the rest of the voyage. On the eighth night, they slept at anchor, and in the morning, they passed into Bristol Channel. As the ship neared the harbor, Marion and Ruth stood at the rail, watching the upended prows and funnels of bombed ships loom out of the fog at strange angles, blackened and half-sunk, sharpening from vague phantoms into ruined hulks and fading away again. London was blackness against the taxi windows. On the train from Bristol, a steward had come around as the evening faded and closed the curtains. The lights inside the train were dim and blue, as were the lights in the station. And once they were outside, it seemed as though Britain had disappeared entirely. Marion was crammed in one taxi with Ruth and Sylvie and their handbags and train cases. The larger luggage rode behind with Zip in another. The driver slowed, making a turn, and something greenish-white slid by outside, glowing, a conical apparition with two orbiting moons. "What was that?" Sylvie said. "A ghost," said Ruth. "Don't say that," said Sylvie.
"Only a copper," said the driver. "They paint their capes and gloves with phosphorescence."
Peering out, Marion began to see the blackness was less total than it had first seemed. Downward angled slits in the covers on the taxi's headlights allowed a faint glow out onto the road. And here and there, the white-painted bumpers of other cars came and went. Traffic signals, reduced to small floating crosses of red or green, hung in the dark. When they stopped at one, Marion could make out the passing shapes of pedestrians and a handsome set of steps leading to a jumble of rubble. "It's the underworld out there, isn't it?" said Ruth. "The kingdom of the shades."
"Get yourself some white gloves, that's my advice," said the driver. "Some bit of white to wave around is what you want for hailing taxis."
"Or for hailing the boatman," Ruth said, "to take us across the River Styx." "Don't be spooky," said Sylvie. "I'm afraid of the dark."
"If you'd been here for the Blitz," the driver said, "you'd know there's worse things than dark."
He stopped short behind a bus that had loomed up suddenly and cliff-like, a large white circle painted on its blunt end.
"Like what?" said Sylvie.
"Sylvie?" warned Ruth.
"Like fire," said the driver.
The lobby of the hotel was a bubble of noise and light, crisscrossed by uniforms, insulated from the darkness by a shell of sandbags and heavy curtains. There was a note from Jackie Cochran, wishing them welcome and saying she would meet them for breakfast. Sylvie and Zip had a double on the fifth floor, and Ruth and Marion were on the sixth in singles with a shared bathroom. Marion, lying fully dressed on the bed, realized she hadn't been able to close a door behind herself, to be fully alone anywhere other than in the toilet, since Montreal. She shut her eyes and pressed her hands against them. Auroras traveled across her lids. Behind the door, running water and gentle splashes signaled that Ruth was taking a bath. A memory of the woman in the hotel in Cordova came to Marion, but she pushed the thought away. She got up and turned out the light, slid in between the window and its heavy velvet curtain. In the time since they'd arrived, the thick cloud had broken apart into gliding silver rafts. A bright half-moon hung high over the blacked-out city. Beyond the ink spill she knew to be Hyde Park, roofs and chimneys and towers rambled into the distance, moonlight glinting off them as though off ice on mountaintops. Missoula, August 1942. Not long after Marion arrived in London. Caleb was sitting on a stump he used for chopping wood. Jamie, standing behind him, lifted the same heavy scissors Caleb had used on Marion's hair long ago and cut off his braid.
The long, severed black weight of it flopped dead and glossy in Jamie's fist.
What should I do with this? He said.
Keep it as a memento.
Jamie dropped the braid in Caleb's lap.
No, thanks. It's all yours.
He did his best to snip the rest short.
It's a little patchy.
Caleb ran a hand over his scalp.
I'm sure the army won't mind finishing the job.
Poetic justice for the way Marion used to look.
I never said I was any good at cutting hair. I was just the only one who'd do it.
Do you hear from her?
No.
Something in Caleb's voice precluded further questions. Jamie said,
She's in London.
Good for her.
Speculatively, Jamie snipped at a bit of hair behind Caleb's ear and winced at the result. He said,
Are you still seeing the teacher?
No, I couldn't quite get to the slippers and pipe.
Jamie thought Caleb might be using some kind of euphemism.
What does that mean?
It means I can't be tamed, Jamie boy.
Caleb slapped the severed braid against his thigh. When he spoke again, he was more serious.
It's better this way. No one to say goodbye to.
Caleb had written Jamie to say he was enlisting, and Jamie had come from Oregon to see him off. The paperwork was already signed. Caleb would leave when they told him to. Soon. The recruiters had been very interested in his experience as a hunting guide, he said. He'd told them he was 26, not 30. Jamie still didn't know what he would do. Marion had visited him in early April on her way to New York. He'd told her about seeing Sarah Fahey in Seattle.
She said she wished she could fight. Easy enough to say.
It is frustrating not to be allowed to really do anything, Marion said.
Yes, I know. I do know that. She also said we all must be brave. I'm not interested in bravery for its own sake. But this war...
He trailed off. Yes, Marion said. I know.
What should I do?
He looked at her fearfully. What I'd like is for you to live in peace and be safe. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter what you do. You going to war won't tip the balance. Can't you get a job painting recruitment posters or something?
That seems like a cop-out, convincing other people to go and die.
I doubt you'd personally convince anyone, no matter how good an artist you are.
You take risks. You're brave.
It's not the same, she'd said. I really want a chance to fly those planes. Not that I don't want to pitch in, I do. But I'm not doing it purely on principle. There's something I want in it, whereas you just want to live harmlessly, and the war means abandoning that. Anyway, the ATA might not even take me.
They'll take you, Jamie had said.
After the haircut, when he and Caleb were deep into a bottle, Jamie said,
What would happen if I couldn't do it?
Do what?
Caleb was lying on his back on the cot in his cabin, one arm under his head. Jamie sat in the rocking chair. The windows were open to the warm night.
Fight.
You'd probably die. But you'll die anyway, someday.
Come on.
You might not know until you're in the thick of it.
Then it'll be too late.
I think probably most guys can't really fight. They're just there, adding numbers. You could get a job where you don't have to shoot at anyone, you know. There are lots of other jobs.
Everyone keeps saying that.
Marion thinks I should make propaganda. You could be a cook or something like that.
Besides Barrett's scissors, Caleb had claimed Wallace's ancient gramophone after the house was sold, and he heaved up and went to it. Choosing a record, he set it in place, cranked the machine, dropped the needle.
Debussy. After the first few notes, Jamie remembered being a child peering through the banister while, below, Wallace and friends argued about art. "Do they let you choose?" Caleb sat on the cot, cross-legged, and lit a cigarette.
"Probably not. Have you ever killed anything? A bird, even?"
"Spiders and flies. Fish."
"What if tomorrow we went after elk? I'd take you. The rut's just starting. It's interesting out there."
In hopes that Caleb would not see how abhorrent he found the idea, Jamie studied the bottom of his cup, sluiced the whiskey around.
"It seems wasteful to kill something just to prove to myself that I can. All these city hunters I take out there, that's what they're doing. But the truth is, there are too many elk and deer now that